Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We're coming your way an hour earlier than typical so we can bring you live NPR gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. That comes underway at 10 o'clock and probably will go rather late, just as last night's did into the 11 o'clock hour. We have a lot to talk about in this hour of Air Talk, entertainment-related stories to begin, and then KPCC political reporter Libby Denkman has been on top of a story that's fascinating. It's about the election systems in Los Angeles County, the hardware that's going to be part of it, the election centers which are debuting for people to vote over a period of days. So she's going to talk with us about the enterprise reporting that she's done on that. And then we'll preview day two of the impeachment trials. We take you up to NPR. We begin with the Recording Academy, where things are in an uproar. The CEO of the organization was put on leave and an investigation launched into allegations that she engaged in bullying behavior toward a staff member who had filed a complaint. Well, her legal team responded today with allegations of discrimination and sexual harassment in a filing with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Joining us to talk about all this just days ahead of Sunday night's Grammy Awards is Jem Aswad, who's senior music writer for Variety. Jem, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
So this has blown up into a mess for the Academy. So take us back, first of all, to the suspension or whatever you'd call it while this investigation is taking place. Was there just one allegation against the now on leave CEO, Deborah Dugan?
Well, there are sort of two things going on there. The specific allegation against her, and she was placed on administrative leave. She has not been fired, although it's almost impossible to imagine her coming back. The specific allegation was that she of misconduct against a senior female employee on the Academy staff. That person is widely believed to be her assistant, who had been the assistant of her predecessor. Now, the things at the Academy have been in a bit of an uproar over the last 2 years, ever since Neil Portnow, the former head of the Academy, said that female executives and musicians needed to step up in order to be recognized. Now, he misspoke when he said that, but it did expose the diversity problems that the Academy has had. So there are politics at play there, but the generally accepted view is that they're using an allegation of misconduct. They say that she was verbally abusive or something like that to this person. But what it really is she was number one, not a great fit for the Academy's culture. Apparently, she came in with a mandate to make dramatic changes, but the Academy is very established and the power there is very entrenched. And even though the former CEO had stepped down, the forces that made the Academy into the way it is are still there, and they're fighting back against Deborah Dugan, the one who's been placed on administrative leave. They're fighting back very aggressively. There's more drama to come today, that's for sure.
Well, and I think the bigger issue for the general public beyond the alleged behavior of people within the Grammy organization, the Recording Academy, is her allegation that once the membership of the Grammys come up with their slate of potential nominees in a category, that then the committees that whittle that number down to the formal nominees is rife with self-interest dealing, with people that are even up for nominations being, you know, part of the decision makers in that process, and that essentially she's alleging that's a corrupt project, process. That's a big deal.
That is an enormous deal, and that's what takes this out of inside baseball, quite frankly, because there's a specific allegation in there that an artist, I can't remember the calculus they used exactly, but there's an artist who placed pretty far down the shortlist for the nominees, was elevated to the top and was nominated over Ariana Grande and Ed Sheeran. Now, that would probably be a pop category. We could probably figure out who it was. I don't really want to go there. But
yeah, you'd hate to undermine someone who may have very legitimately been the nominee.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but if I were an artist who, you know, and I were reading that and I were one of those artists, I'd be enraged. You know, I mean, because what that basically says is that these people lost a nomination to politics, you know, in music industry politics. And sure, things like that happen all the time, you know, and you can also say that just because someone is, you know, working with an artist or related to an artist or something like that, that does not that doesn't mean that person isn't a legitimate candidate, you know, or talented or anything like that. But it certainly is messy.
Well, and I'm sure that the Academy has the problem that many sort of specialty organizations do, because the people who are often most knowledgeable about particular categories of music have worked with a wide number of people under consideration for honors in those categories. That sort of incestuousness, that's sort of built into this, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's built into most businesses and you know, relationships in the world in a lot of ways. It's a very fine line to draw, you know, but you would think that after, what's it been, 62 years, that there would be safeguards in place where, you know, there were clear guidelines about it, and I'm not sure that there are.
We're talking with Jem Aswad, who is senior music editor for Variety. We're talking with him about the huge uproar at the Grammys with charges and countercharges. It's an employment issue, but of course involving a major cultural organization. Also with us, Angela Reddock-Wright, employment attorney, mediator, and workplace investigator. She's managing attorney of the L.A. firm Reddock Law Group. Ms. Reddock-Wright, thank you very much for being with us. Obviously, we got different investigations, potentially an EEOC governmental one. The Academy had announced it has two different third-party investigations. So how is this likely to play out?
Thank you, Larry. So the EEOC investigation, that is a requirement that you file an administrative claim either with the EEOC, which is a federal agency. It's called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a federal government agency, or with the equivalent of your state administrative agency. And so in New York, it would be the New York Employment Housing Commission, most likely. So Ms. Dugan chose to file with the EEOC. They will receive her complaint, and then she has the option as the complainant to either request that they investigate the complaint or to request an immediate right to sue letter. If they investigate, then they will interview her. They will interview other witnesses that may have knowledge of her claims, which, by the way, I believe her claims are most likely for discrimination, harassment, and possibly retaliation, that when she came forward to make these complaints about the practices, the behind-the-scenes practices, that she was retaliated against by being placed on administrative leave.
And are there whistleblower statutes that apply in the case of a CEO that is attempting to have, you know, what she's alleging of bad behavior dealt with? Or is that not a factor here?
Yeah, look, a retaliation claim is the equivalent of a whistleblower action
okay.
in a private employer situation such as this. So certainly she has, you know, whistleblower status in coming forward. But they're likely to interview witnesses and as a part of an investigation and then make a finding as to whether they believe her claims are substantiated anyway or if there's any merit to her claims. If she opts for an immediate right to sue letter, that empowers her and her attorneys to immediately to go to a civil court and file a complaint alleging her claims, whatever they may be, discrimination, harassment, retaliation. So we're still waiting to see if she's going to request an immediate right to sue letter or request a simultaneous investigation to the two third-party investigations that are happening internally at the Grammy.
In a case like this, do these usually settle, or the fact that the allegations so quickly went from zero to 60 and became public, is it now less likely that's going to happen?
You know, I think at some point the matter will settle, just because there's a lot at stake both for her. You know, the Grammys are also alleging that she engaged in improper conduct, which is why they're having a separate investigation done. And then obviously she has claims against the Grammy organization, which I presume that they don't want to get out either. So I think at some point the case is likely to settle, just because there's so much at stake and so much information that could come out that would be damaging both to Ms. Dugan as well as to the Grammys organization. So I think both parties have motivation to ultimately settle. When that happens, we don't know yet, but I suspect that that will be somewhere down the road.
We're talking with employment specialist attorney Angela Reddick Wright of Los Angeles. Also with us, former prosecutor Ambrosio Rodriguez, currently criminal defense attorney at the Rodriguez Law Group in Los Angeles, and he led the sex crimes prosecution team in the Riverside County District's Attorney's Office. He's with us to talk about a separate legal matter, but entertainment related, as former producer Harvey Weinstein, the opening statements are scheduled to get underway in his New York City rape trial today. Ambrosio, it's good to have you with us. This is the start of a much anticipated trial. What are some of the most important aspects of this trial over the weeks to come?
Well, look, I think this trial is going to be a blockbuster in terms of the amount of fighting between the prosecution and the defense and the aggressiveness from both sides. I think that there are a couple of major issues in this case. The first one is that the biggest hurdle that the Weinstein defense has to overcome, their biggest hurdle, is the fact that there are multiple victims. And in sexual assault cases, when you have multiple victims, women that don't know each other, all making similar accusations, that's a hard thing to overcome. But for the prosecution, I think one of the things that they have to deal with and try to explain to the jurors in order to get a conviction is the fact that, as reported in the New York Times today, the defense has multiple emails of these alleged victims maintaining a relationship with Harvey Weinstein after the alleged sexual assault. And I think that's very hard for people to get their heads around. I think it's very hard to prove that a woman was sexually assaulted, yet continue to keep a relationship with her, you know, rapist. This isn't a situation where we're talking about a child in a sexual molestation case where the alleged, the person accused of committing sex crimes has a parental or custodial control over the child. We're talking about adults. And so how credible is it that to say that I was raped by this man, but I maintain a relationship and I send him all these nice emails and I ask him to come meet my mother?
Now, the judge, as I understand it, Ambrosio, is not allowing the full text of those emails to be read into court. What would be the reason for that, if that might go to the defense's claim that these were consensual encounters?
Well, the judge allowed the defense to talk about it during opening statement, but not to show them during opening statement. And a lot of evidentiary rulings happen at the time either side seeks to introduce certain evidence. And when one witness says something, it might cause evidence that wasn't once allowed to come in. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen very quickly, and it just depends on what the witnesses say. Because if the witnesses says, yes, I sent those emails, then there's nothing to impeach her with. So not to get into the weeds of the law, but like I said, this is going to be, and from what I read, these are two very accomplished attorneys, and it is going to be a long battle. And, you know, I think listeners should also keep in mind that it's not one or the other. It's not guilty or not guilty. It can also be a mixed verdict. It can be a hung jury. The biggest charge, obviously, that the defense is going after is the one that carries life in prison.
We'll
see what happens.
Ambrosio, in the Bill Cosby prosecution's first time, there was the hung jury, and then the second trial, as I recall, and correct me if my memory's bad, but then you had multiple women making allegations of very similar assaults by Cosby as a part of the prosecution case against him. That was allowed in. In this case, I believe there are going to be women who are not party to this actual prosecution, but who will be able to testify alleging that he had done similar things with them to what is alleged in the rape prosecution. And I'm just curious, when did this start getting introduced in the cases? Is it a fairly recent phenomenon? Because obviously these are cases for which no trial was held. You have someone who is attesting to a similar pattern, but there's been nothing adjudicated as to the claim of those other incidents.
Right. These are called prior bad acts, and this has been going on. This has been the law in California for at least 25 years. As long as I've been an attorney, this has been part of the judicial system. And it's used both in sexual assault cases and domestic violence cases and family violence cases to show a pattern. And when the DA brings in other alleged victims to, you know, when the crimes aren't charged, right, to establish a pattern, the DA doesn't even have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these other accusations happen. They just have to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence or other evidentiary hurdles, but not beyond a reasonable doubt, in order to establish a pattern. And the reason that that's allowed is because, as in the Weinstein case and in the overwhelming majority, and I'm talking in the 90% plus, there's usually never physical evidence. So it depends on the credibility of the witness. And in order to buttress, to support the credibility of the witness, the law allows prosecutors to bring in other witnesses that say, even though the crime isn't charged, to say, hey, he did the same thing to me. This is what happened to me.
Also with us again, Attorney Angela Reddock-Wright. Angela, it seems that, you know, this is a big challenge for the defense, as it was in the Cosby case. If you're going to have multiple women alleging, there is a standard operating method, abusive method that Weinstein used, and they all have similar accounts.
Yes, and I hear what our DA is saying, our former prosecutor is stating. I think that what the defense can argue is that, or what the prosecution can argue is that, although these women continue to communicate with Weinstein, that they were communicating with him because they wanted to work in Hollywood, and he was the doorkeeper to Hollywood. So they, although they had previously bad experiences with him, had been assaulted by him, that they felt the need to stay in touch in order to be able to move forward in the industry. He had just that much power in Hollywood that you had to go through Weinstein to do anything. So they essentially were left with no options. That's certainly the argument I would make.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. That's Angela Reddock-Wright, who is an attorney, mediator, and workplace investigator based in Los Angeles. Ambrosio Rodriguez, who is a criminal defense attorney and who headed the sex crimes team in the Riverside County District Attorney's Office prior to going into practice for himself as a defense attorney. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. Back in just one moment, we'll be talking with Libby Denkman, KPCC politics reporter, and she has a lot to say about the upcoming election. Back in one minute.